Category E5, News Reporter of the Year, Shona Murray.
Now, the name Guantanamo Bay will forever be associated with the war on terror, the CIA, enhanced interrogation techniques, and as a facility that imprisons people despite their being cleared of wrongdoing. Shona Murray is visiting there this week for a number of special reports for News Talk, and she's on the line now. Good morning, Shona. What have you been able to see in the last few days?
Well, I've been given access to the parts of Guantanamo Bay that house the majority of prisoners. I was also yesterday taken to the medical facility where I was given a demonstration of the force feeding procedure that is performed on those who are still on hunger strike here. But first, I went to see where it all began in January 2002, in the early days of the so-called War on Terror, when the notorious Camp X-Ray opened to incarcerate almost 300 Al-Qaeda-linked suspects. Now, listeners will remember the images of men in orange jumpsuits being carried on stretchers to interrogation houses or even chained in kneeling positions in the metal wire cages. This is one of the staff sergeants who explained Camp X-Ray from the US military's perspective. I should say that all US military people in the report will remain anonymous for security purposes.
They would have their eyes covered, and that's so they couldn't see where they were or who they were with. They had them wearing earphones, but more of earmuffs, so they wouldn't be able to converse with each other, kind of maybe plot something, or just kind of confine them. When they did bring them in to kneel them down, that was for security measure reasons. When they brought them in over to here, that was actually a shower area. They would bring them in here and shower them. And another reason you see in the old pictures, they're wearing masks. One of the reasons for that was is they actually did have two positive cases of tuberculosis. So they would have those masks on so they couldn't spread their tuberculosis with other detainees or with the guard staff here.
They were also carried in on stretchers as well because they were shackled.
When they would transport them back and forth from the interrogation tents, what happened was is they would have to walk so far with those shackles on, it started to chafe them and cause like rashing or abrasions or whatever on their hands and their feet. So somebody got the idea, well, instead of hurting them with the shackles, we can make this. And somebody attached a stretcher, or what we call a litter, onto a frame where you could put some wheels on it, and they can push them to keep them from getting hurt from walking so far with the shackles on. Well, what happened is, and somebody said, oh, look, they're hurting them. They had medical staff here that was stationed 24 hours a day, routinely making rounds throughout the camp to visually observe the physical health of the detainees. The detainees were just like now, regularly weighed at least once a month to monitor their weight, because like you mentioned, it's hot out here. It doesn't matter what you're doing, you're going to lose weight. And inside the infirmary over here, it could hold up to 50 detainees if needed, 10 per tent. They were the tents that were in there. They could perform level one basic first aid to include initial life-saving steps, localizing wounds, administering medication, providing IVs. The serious stuff, like level three, serious injuries and stuff like that, if something were like that to happen or a serious health issue, they would not do that here. They would take them to the Fleet Hospital, the Naval Hospital, same place where we would go to treat them to make sure they were okay.
If you had 300 people here, why would you need an infirmary for 50? That's a high proportion of people you expect to be in need of medical assistance.
It's always better to be proactive than reactive, I guess.
And if they're all sort of shackled or in their small cells, why would you expect them to have serious first aid issues or broken legs?
You never know what could happen in transportation, and you never know what somebody's capable of once they're put inside a cell. I mean, it's better to have it than not have it, because when you don't have it, it'll probably be about the time that you're going to need it.
Camp X-Ray closed after 3 months and the detainees were transferred to a bigger area, but I suppose the legacy of that place is important because of the interrogation rooms that are located there for suspects, the people who were picked up in Afghanistan or Pakistan or in other parts of the world.
Yes, in 2002 the detainees were transferred to Camp Delta nearby, which is a similar outdoor facility. But in the early days after 9/11 and the Afghanistan war, as the suspects were arrested, the priority of course to the CIA was to get the information on bin Laden and his cohorts. And this took place, as we know, in countries across the world, but also in the five interrogation sheds, which are just yards from the cells.
So when you come in here, what you've got is you've got a few benches that are set up around the room. They would bring the detainees in here. You have your table that is set up in the middle of the room with a bench attached to it. Everything is either fastened to the wall or to the floor. That way you can't remove it. They would do their interrogations. They would bring them in here, ask them questions, probably something like, do you know what's going on? What happened during this time? Do you know of anything that's going to happen from here on out? You know, those type of questions. Other than that, I couldn't tell you because I wasn't here, so I don't know. Torture? I have no, as far as I know, no. Just questioning as far as I know. And as far as I'm concerned, that's all that happened. Like I said, I wasn't here, so I couldn't tell you if there was or wasn't.
During that period, there was a sanctioned use of enhanced interrogation procedures.
I don't know.
Did you hear that it used to take place here?
No.
The size of this room is very low ceiling, but there's space for a lot of people to sit.
You've got it. Like I said, it's a low ceiling. It looks to be probably a 10 by 12 room. You do have a lot of seats. And like I said, that was probably for the guard force to come in here, because you would have your guard force in here, you would have whoever's doing the interrogation in here, and you would have the detainee in here. So you would kind of want a few seats. In this room over here, there's really nothing in there, but that is where your interpreters would stay. They would be in here in this room right here. They would sit in this empty room right here.
Were there lawyers?
That I couldn't tell you. Interrogations, detainees, guards, and interpreters that were involved in these rooms. Other than that, I don't know who all came in here. Sure, the only interrogations that go on here now are between banana rats and pigeons.
You visited the camps that prisoners are in today, and these ones were built more recently.
Yes, the two main prison facilities are Camp 5 and Camp 6, built in 2006. And Camp 5 is for what's called non-compliant detainees. The hunger strikers are all in here, for example, as are those who are deemed dangerous or who engage in violence against the guards. Camp 6 is for those who are compliant, and therefore they have privileges. They have a TV, they have a common area. And for a time, I was actually able to observe these detainees through a one-sided window. But here's a military prison guard telling me about the conditions for all of those involved.
In front of you is our basic issue items that every detainee in Camp 5 receive. On the top is what we offer our compliant detainees. On the bottom is what we offer our non-compliant detainees. A few differences of note are the number of books, which is 8 for compliant detainees, and non-compliant receive 2. The color of the uniform is also different. Non-compliant detainees wear the orange uniform as a reminder to a guard force that detainee has acted against a guard or the rules of the facility within the past 20 to 30 days. As you can see here, this cell is virtually indestructible. Every detainee in Camp 5 is either on a 1 or 3 minute check. That means every 1 minute or every 3 minute, a guard is looking into the cell, assessing the detainee for accountability as well as the detainee status. This here is a splash box, a modification we received from the Bureau of Prisons. Splashing is a method of non-compliance by the detainee to show displeasure with a guard or the rules of the facility. To splash, the detainee will make a concoction in a styrofoam cup consisting of feces, urine, rotten milk, mixed together, and then either flung at the passing member of the guard force or into the tier to contaminate it. The way the splash box is used is that the feed tray slot is first secured. Once the feed tray slot is secured, the guard will then open the splash box. And for example, if a detainee asks for a bottle of water, they will place the bottle of water in here. The feed tray slot will, the splash box will then be secured, and the feed tray slot will be unsecured, and the detainee will retrieve that item. Once that is done, if the detainee has any trash or anything else that needs to come out of the cell, they will place it in the splash box, and the guard will retrieve the item, secure the feed tray slot, and retrieve the item from there. This is our splash guards that we installed here on the bottom and also the top. As you can see over there and on the back of the cell, this is to prevent the detainees from getting any type of concoction into the tier. If you look up, the discoloration you see on the ceiling is, that's actually our noise dampening system, the foam you see up there. Because this facility is concrete, sound does travel, so that limits the amount of sound that we get through here. But as you can see, the discoloration is from a previous flashing incident in this area.
How did it get up there from in here? Can you explain?
They throw it out. It's from the feed tray slot. It gets thrown out at the guard so it can go anywhere.
Shona Murray in Guantanamo Bay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Pat.
Now we want to, at 10 minutes past 9 on News Talk Breakfast, return to a topic that is something of a hobby horse of ours. It relates to adoption and access to records. Earlier this year, President Michael D. Higgins described to News Talk as horrific the fact that the state is withholding information from families who underwent adoptions, many of them illegal and enforced in Ireland. There are over 60,000 adoption files held by the HSE amongst private adoption agencies, church representatives, all of which are the sole source of people's original identities. The popularity of the film Philomena, a true story of an Irish woman who had her baby forcibly adopted, has helped bring the issue to public consciousness. Well, our own Shona Murray has been covering this issue, and she spoke to the president about it some time ago, but she's also spoken to victims of forced adoptions. She joins us now in studio. Shona, good morning.
Good morning, Ivan.
Tell us about Marion.
Marion gave birth in St. Finbar's Maternity Hospital in Cork just over 40 years ago. She was 18. She got pregnant at 17. And her parents, essentially with the help of a number of nuns, a number of people working for the state, colluded in taking any of her own decisions out of her hands. She was locked into her room above her parents' pub until she was 8 months pregnant, so no one could see her. At 8 months, she was forcibly induced because her family had an aunt coming over from England and they didn't want anyone to see her pregnant. And she told me about the day she was brought into hospital.
Put me up on a drip, broke my bottles.
That must have been very painful.
Shocking. It was the worst experience I ever had in my life, I'd say. Because I didn't know what was happening to me. I actually didn't know what was happening. I didn't know it was going to have the child. I can remember I was screaming and roaring inside the ward, and I was after pulling out all the drips and the blood was everywhere, and it was horrendous. But eventually I had a little boy.
Did they offer you any sympathy, any pain relief?
No, I don't remember getting any sympathy. Obviously I must have got pain relief, but it didn't do much for me at the time. All I remember then after that was I was told that I was going down to Bessborough. There was an ambulance at the door.
So did you get any time to sleep? And when you eventually gave birth, did you hold your baby?
No. I held him in the ambulance. They put him into my arms in the ambulance on the way to Bessborough. And there was another girl in the ambulance with me. I can still remember our baby. He was beautiful. He had streaks in his hair. And I was looking at my baby and I could see the little dimple on his chin. And I was terrified.
This is truly shocking stuff. So she was induced a month early just because of the sense of family shame because an aunt was visiting from England. Now, did she know all along that her baby was going to be adopted when she went in to be induced?
Well, as you heard from her there, she wasn't given any information about her fate and what was going to happen to her. But I did ask her, did she hold out any hope that she might be able to keep her baby?
A part of me hoped I would, but then there was another part of me knew that I was fooling myself if I thought that, because they wouldn't have treated me the way they treated me if they were going to let me keep my baby. So I suppose I had enough of intelligence to know that they were going to take him, but I didn't think they'd take him the way that they did. Like, when I got down, I couldn't walk. I was stitched and clipped, and when I got down to Bessborough, a nun was standing at the back of the ambulance and the doors opened and she just put out her arms. I actually thought she was helping me out of the ambulance because I couldn't walk. And she walked away with the child. Just turned her back and walked away. And I was put upstairs into a cast iron bed with a bedpan. Left there for a few days. One of the other mothers one of the girls had a pregnant Flo, used to bring me up my food, and I was taken home after a few days, and it was never again to be mentioned then.
You're listening to the story of Marion. It relates to 1974. Shona, what happened after she gave birth?
Well, 2 days later, when she was still in the mother and baby home on her own, completely prohibited from seeing her baby who was downstairs, she signed adoption papers. Now, she doesn't have any recollection of this, but she does recognise the fact that she probably did sign them, but she was so traumatised at the time that she wouldn't be able to remember it. And I asked her about that period, and even just the 20 minutes she did have with her son, who she called Anthony.
He was just beautiful, like, it was beautiful. The same as the rest of my children were. He was absolutely beautiful. I thought I'd have time in him, but I didn't. I had, I suppose, just the trip from St. Fambars to Besborough, and that was it.
20 minutes or so?
Yeah.
For a moment in the back of the ambulance, was there a semblance of happiness just holding him?
Yeah. I just wished I could keep him. Of course I wanted to keep him. And to be honest about it, I have been through a lot at that age, and I know in my own heart and soul that I would have made a very good mother to him. Like, there was no financial shortage. I believe they were all paid off. Nuns, doctors. My mum came down, and as far as I know, I was told afterwards that she supplied all the baby stuff, the pram and the, whatever he needed, and they were all brought down. She saw him, but I didn't.
And you were upstairs in this room with the bedpan, having given birth with stitches and not allowed to see him.
Mm-hmm.
And did you ever have a conversation with her about, did her heart not melt when she saw her own grandson?
I believe it did. I believe it did. A part of me believes that she would have kept him.
Okay, so Marion loses her firstborn son. What happened in her life then?
Well, she got married actually within a couple of years later, and she did have a family and 4 children. And she kept it from her husband at the time. But what happened was, inadvertently, her mother used to go back and forth with her for years, calling all sorts of names after the birth. And one day her husband came into the house, and he heard her mother speaking to her about this and asked her about it. And then he assisted with her to going back and forth to Besborough, finding information.
Yeah, and so she had this deep yearning inside herself, Marion, to reunite with her firstborn son.
All her
son.
Life, yeah.
And, okay, how did she get on then, well, in terms of reuniting with him, finding out about him, where he'd gone to, whatever?
So she went back and forth to Besborough and was stonewalled all throughout her life. There was all sorts of excuses. First of all, that he had to be 18. And then when she got to that milestone, they just refused to give information. Every year she brought down birthday cards, and they just stonewalled her completely. But then she had a friend who'd been through something similar, and who put in touch with someone who was an expert in record and data research. And very fortunately, she found him within a day or so on that basis, because he happened to be the only baby born in Cork with that name on that day. And she got in touch with them, and it has been very difficult, but they do have a relationship now.
The day they took my child, part of me died. And even though we're after reuniting, that part of me is still dead. Like, I gave them, they took a baby from out of my arms. They took a beautiful baby. I know I'm getting back a man who I never... As a baby, I never changed. I never fed. Never did anything with him. There's terrible grief there, to be honest. Desperate grief. And how long more are they going to let it go on, like? How long more are they going to deny children, adopted children, how long more are they going to deny them the rights to their identity? Like, I believe people took their own lives off this kind of stuff. When are the government going to turn around and allow children find their parents? It's all these, we're stuck with all these names, birth mothers, adoptees, adopted parents. We're all human beings. We're all human. And each and every child that was adopted illegally or otherwise, but mine was definitely forced and illegal anyway, they're all entitled to know who they are, where they came from. They're entitled to their medical records.